Good evening and welcome to the Michigan Writers Series. I'm Stephanie Mattson, a reference library assistant and a publicity coordinator for events such as this, so I'm very pleased to see all of you here, especially on Halloween and on the eve of the big game, so go green. That said, I'm pleased to introduce to you this evening novelist Ranelle Burton. Ms. Burton is a writer in residence in the Interdisciplinary Studies program at Wayne State University and co-founder of the program's Detroit Institute for Creative Writers. Her debut novel, The Root Worker, was published in hardcover and paperback by the Overlook Press and Penguin Putnam, respectively, and has been reviewed and featured in O Magazine, Publishers Weekly, Ebony, Essence, Black Issues Book Reviews, the Chicago Tribune, Madison Times, and the Ann Arbor News. The novel has received national recognition as a Borders Books Recommended Book, BookSense 76 Independent Booksellers Association pick, and a 2002 Great Lakes Book Award finalist. As a literary consultant, Ranelle is the author and facilitator of the Literary Landscape Workshop series and has been featured in the 2001 Guide to Literary Agents, a Writer's Digest publication, and Putting Your Passion into Print, to be published by Workman in 2004. Ranelle is a Michigan regional representative for the International Women's Writing Guild and workshop director for the Guild's Summer Writers Conferences at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York. So please help me in welcoming Ranelle Burton.
Hi. Thank you for coming. I'm just so pleased to see so many people here, especially tonight with everything going on, and I was sort of thinking about, oh boy, everybody's going to be at all the game, pre-game festivities and all that, and I'm just glad to see you, and I'm so honored. Thank you. So give yourselves a hand. I give you a hand. There you go. I'm kind of an informal person, so I don't like to just stand and read. I think I'll put myself to sleep and bore myself, so... I sort of like to talk and read and talk back and forth with the audience, get an exchange going on with you. If you don't mind, then that's the way that I like doing it. Rick, there's my friend Rick in the back here. He's the editor of the Wayne Literary Review. Hi, Rick. And so I'm not a behind the podium person, as you can see, so I'm taking a chair. Why did I write this novel? Did anybody read it? I want to start asking a question. Did anybody read the novel? You did? Okay. So here it goes. Does anyone not know about the novel? Sort of. It's okay if you say I'm not, but it's okay. Okay, good. That gives me a jumping off point. So this is where I'm going to jump off. With the question of why did I write the novel, what made me decide to write the novel? I lived in a world one time where root working was practiced in a community in Detroit where root working was practiced. Root working is an offshoot or a derivative of the African-based religion Voodoo. That's an actual religion, and root working is a sort of half-remembered, sort of bastardized version of voodoo. And so it's voodoo absent the religion. And fast forward a lot of years later, here I am in the larger world that doesn't know anything really about working, except what's except the popular versions or the popular TV or movie type versions of what voodoo is, and with the popular notion that voodoo doesn't harm anyone except people who believe in it, and no harm can come to the person except the person who believes in it. Which I knew was not wasn't true at all. It's not even not necessarily true, but not true. And what happens with that is nobody addresses nobody ever gets a glimpse or a picture of, well, from the outsider, you get this sort of mysterious, mystical view, sort of exotic view of, you go in there and this lady is mixing these potions, just sort of like love potion number 9, and coming up with these things. Or if you want to off your ex-husband, you go get something from the voodoo person. Your ex-husband gets off to whoever is looking for you. And you know what? That's not really what it is. In fact, the religion voodoo is not based, it's not an evil religion. It's not based on doing harm to someone. A voodoo practitioner does not use voodoo to work harm on a person. They use voodoo to take the harm away from a person. But as an African-based religion, if you you use voodoo, if a voodoo practitioner uses voodoo to do any harm to a person, that the belief is that what that person does comes back to sort of bite them in the tail. Okay, it happens to them. Sort of what goes around comes around. So, but in the world of rootworking, something else happens. Since it is a half-remembered, a sort of bastardized version of what voodoo really is, the whole meaning of it is distorted. And in that distortion of meaning, other things begin to happen. And yes, the voodoo practitioner does claim to use it to do harm. Okay, if you want to get rid of someone, I can tell you how to do this. And if you want to kill someone, I can tell you how to kill someone and all that. And so here's this. Well, the people who are missed in this whole scenario are the people who actually live in that world and what it does to them, not the voodoo practitioner, but the families and the relationships and the communities and all of that. What does that belief system do to these people, and how, or does it? And it absolutely does, because what happens is, if for a root worker to thrive, root worker is a person who works roots. Working roots is based on a sort of the notion of, well, I know the right mix of, it used to be roots and herbs to do certain things. And then it went from roots and herbs to a lot of other things. And I talk about that in the novel. To do these things. Well, here it is. What happens with all of that, and what happens to people who are in the middle of that world, and especially children where that's believed, where that belief exists? I wrote the novel to illustrate, to give a sense of what that world was. Now, how did I start, even begin with the notion of, well, where does this discussion come from, and how do you get into this novel? I was talking to a friend. I mean, this is many, many, many years later. And what I found is that I'm always passing between the two worlds. And it's a funny thing. When you're passing between these two worlds, there's this one-way dialogue where nothing is really understood. The whole notion of what that is misunderstood. And the whole notion of what's right or wrong or good or bad or even pathological is misunderstood, because the language of one world doesn't apply to the language of the other world. Even though you're talking about English, the words, and the words that have the same definition in both worlds have an altogether different meaning and an altogether different view and an altogether different way of processing it. As in, what makes sense? I was talking to a friend one day who knew nothing about the world of voodoo and working and all that. And I don't even know how the conversation came up. And he said, well, And he was trying to make sense of it within the language that he understands, which is the language of the larger world. And he said, everything was, well, that doesn't make sense. Why don't they just do this? Or why don't they run the workers out of there, and all of that. And mentally, I automatically went on automatic mentally into that world, into the language of that world. And I'm saying, well, no, what you're saying doesn't make sense because of these reasons. And so he said, why don't you write about this? Because, I said, why don't I write about this? Because maybe if I wrote an explanation of what this is, then maybe you could understand what I'm talking about. And I found that in trying to write about it, there's no words in the, nothing in the English language that makes sense of it. So here you have this breakdown of the two languages, this whole disconnect between the two languages, even though they're the same words. We found that we had two different discussions going, using the same words, two different understandings of the same discussion. And I knew that because I had become so entrenched in the larger world over so many years. I'm pretty old. And over a bigger part of my life, I'm entrenched in the larger world. And I saw these two languages, this dance between two worlds, two languages, and two things not understood on both sides, both ends. And so I decided, well, the only way that you can understand is that you have to actually be there and live it in order to understand what this is and what I'm talking about. And so, of course, he couldn't be there because he was an outsider. That world presents itself in an altogether different way to the outsider. So, like when you go to New Orleans or when you go on Gratiot Avenue in Detroit to one of the root working shops that sells paraphernalia, root working paraphernalia, there's a different face and a different discussion that's presented to you, the outsider. It's all entertainment. And so, of course, you can go in there and you can talk about it and you can get all kinds of things. But the discussion behind that, when you're gone, is something altogether different. And so I decided to not recreate this world, but recreate a sense of what that world is. You cannot recreate something that has already existed, because to create means to make something out of nothing. And if it already exists, how can you create it? And so I created a sense of what that world is and the relationships of that world and what goes on in that world and all that. A real big thing that happens there is this, and it's a fascinating thing I found in going back to draw this and from what is this, is this whole notion of religion. Religion plays a big part in that world. Traditional religion, especially Catholicism, because Catholicism has statues and symbols and beliefs and this whole notion of sin and punishment and hell and purgatory and heaven and all these things. And here's this, all of this that works so well in the world of root working. And that's why the two can sort of mix together. And the language of the two becomes very close and very similar. The symbols are very, very similar, and even adapted and readapted. But again, that language, that those symbols, that religion, becomes a bastardized form of itself. And so, here's the thing with religion, and also what it means, the whole notion and definition of what is evil. And the biggest thing that I found that runs all the way through there is the presentation of the evilness of what it is that is woman, what it is that's female. Female is the ultimate evil in that world. And so everything is linked to what's female, sickness, death, curses, all of that. And so what I wanted to do was begin with a picture of a root worker's chap, and then begin to take you into that world with a picture of the root worker's chap, and through this whole discussion of what goes on and what it is to be, that is female, and what it is that is children, and children in that world are not innocent. And in their innocence, there's no innocence. There's not even an internalization of innocence. A victim is not a victim. A victim is also a victimizer. Even the most innocent of the victims can also do things or think outside of the realm of innocence. And so the root workers tell through the voice of a 12-year-old narrator. And the reason why I chose a 12-year-old is because I had to have a narrator who wasn't judgmental, who didn't judge the world, but who was able to take you right there, present it just for what it is, without seeming like an absolute nut. Because the only way you can talk about it without judgment is to appear as though you're an absolute nut, unless you're a child. Because it warrants explanation, because it warrants judgment to the outside world, but not within that world. And so the 12-year-old narrator is Ellen, who is seen as crazy because she dissociates, she splits. She becomes, in order to endure that world, you have to split, you have to dissociate. Especially if you're singled out as the root cause of everything that goes wrong in that world, illness, death, and all of that. And then it becomes a horrible thing, and you have to split. And it's very, very, very common, not uncommon. And so Sybil wasn't invented with the movie. It was invented long, even further beyond. And it's very, very, very common in that world that you split. And so with that split, there's isolation, very common thing that happens in that world, because that world is an isolated world. And so here's all these levels of isolation that goes beyond isolation from the outside world. It's isolation even to this very, very small thing, isolation within itself, within the self. So not only is that world isolated from the outside world, it's also isolated from the community itself. The family is isolated from people within the family, within relationships, within the self. It's all these levels and layers isolation, and it plays out in a sort of way that is difficult to understand unless you are actually there in that world and what that is. Okay? And even isolation from childhood, and from the isolation from the innocence of childhood, and also isolation from the sophistication of the adult world too, because you have sophisticated adults, adults. With that adult level of sophistication, who's also even isolated from what it is to be an adult, children who are isolated from what it is to be children. Good is isolated from evil, from itself. Good is isolated from the notion of what it is to be good, and so is evil isolated from the notion of what it is to be evil. And so I'm gonna begin with by taking you into the root worker's shop and going from there. And I don't know where we're gonna go with this, but let's see where it's gonna take us. With this discussion. And yeah, if you want to, you can break it up and ask me a question. If it's not making sense, let me know. Okay, and I'll be glad to. I'm not going to say, hey, well, what about this? Well, that doesn't make sense, or clarify this. I'll be glad to stop and do that. I followed the woman up the long steps that led to the room over the store, carrying the big jar with my womanhood rag in it. The short, thick yellow woman answered the door in her red wig and a grin that showed one gold tooth in the middle of a row of yellowish ones. Her round face reminded me of the cherubim painted on the church walls. She's the root worker. She led us inside that dark, musty room that she lives in. I still can't get used to a sickening sweet smell like woman odor mixed with perfume and candle wax. It always makes me dizzy, and this time I felt like throwing up. We went behind the curtain of dusty, ragged blankets that divides the room in half. There was no light in the room except for the candles that lit up the homemade altar in the center of the middle wall. Let me tell you about the altar. It's made out of white painted wood crates that are fading gray and has jars of perfume candles and oil on it. Tiny brown packets of powder are lined up in neat rows in front of the oil, along with what looks like half-burned hair and black bird feathers. Do you remember when I told you that the lady who ran the beauty shop down the street died? The root worker has a picture of that lady hanging above the altar right next to a tiny picture of the woman's mother, and she calls her mother the woman and her father the husband. There's isolation from the parent-child relationship too. And so in this case, she has a picture hanging above the altar right next to a tiny picture of the woman's mother. She calls them souls. She says she lights a candle there every night to keep them trapped inside their likeness. A card table and chairs are in the middle of the room, and a small cooking stove is near the other wall. She uses the oven to heat the room and to dry things for working. I don't know if she uses the stove for cooking, too. I never saw her cook on it. A toilet's near another wall, just that. There's no sink or tub. Just a toilet all by itself with no curtain around it or a door to close. Right where everyone in the room could see what anyone is doing on it. The dead beauty shop lady's husband was there. He lay on a naked mattress on the side of the room where the stove is. He's a little skinny man, dark, with feet that look too big for his body. He had nothing on but his drawers. They say that he married the root worker about 5 or 6 months ago, but it still seemed funny seeing him there with nothing on but his drawers. He got up and pulled his pants on a few minutes after we got there. He laughed and talked with the woman for a while. I couldn't hear what they said to each other. Then he went to the other side of the blanket curtain. And so here's the window into the root worker shop. And if you not notice in the reading, the toilet sits all by itself. There's no privacy. The root worker's new husband is there laying on a mattress out in the middle of the floor with nothing on. But his underwear, his drawers. And I did use a lot of things to symbolize a lot of things in the book. And yes, that is true. There are very few boundaries in that world. There's very little privacy, even though it's private, isolated, and kept out. Every on the outside is kept out. Within that world, there's no boundaries. There's no privacy. And no sacredness, even though there's the talk of the sacred. There's the talk of that. The outsider. What happens when the outsider comes into that world? How is that outsider accepted? With a great deal of suspicion and with a great deal of stay out, okay? Especially if the outsider happens to be a woman, and especially if the outsider is a woman with no husband and no children, a barren woman with no children, and especially if that woman has any connection to the outside, which means that she's a part of the world of the establishment, or seen as part of the world of the establishment. And in this case, there's this woman named Barbara who comes into the world, and they call her, she's called a Sela lady. And there's where I went into being a little bit imaginative, because there's, in the world of root working, there's no such thing as a Sela lady. But there is such a thing as a Sela lady in one very remote village in Africa. And the Sela lady is someone who's thought to carry a curse. The curse that she carries is the curse that's manifested from an unfaithful husband. And so it's sort of like the goddess of getting even with unfaithful husbands kind of person. And what there's this whole notion that when he's unfaithful to his wives, she's able to work something back on him that puts a sickness on him, that makes his wives go crazy and die, and it affects, they're no more good for any man. And then eventually he dies, and so I worked it into it, into the novel, because I thought that was a fascinating thing. But it also symbolizes that whole notion of what it means to be evil, or what's in that world and what is seen as evil, and in the innocence of things or people who can be seen as evil, mostly the outsider. A sailor lady moved to Mr. Stevens' flat across the alley. I don't know much about her, except that's what the old lady next door said she must be, a sailor. I couldn't find it in the dictionary, but I like the way it sounds, like music or dancing or something. And I imagine the sailor lady in a long silver dress singing long, slow songs, and people who dance like blue swans in a dream. Silver blue, like the tiny card that the sailor lady folds up into as if she's packing herself away. Must not have anybody, the woman said when she watched the sailor lady fold out of her car. No husband, no kids. Never did see any. Must not plan on having any. Wouldn't make much sense to have that little piece of nothing. Got to have some man somewhere, Aunt Della told her. Else how could she come up with a car? But even all by herself, it still don't make much sense. All that ass and legs a mile long. Looks like she get one that fits. I think it fits just right. I like to watch her unfold of it like it's a secret sort of box. And she's the only one who knows exactly how to make herself the perfect size to get out of it. She doesn't look like a husband and kids lady, Clarissa. Clarissa's her alter ego who she talks to all the time. She doesn't look like a husband and kids lady, Clarissa. She wears straight skirts and high heels with her toes out. And she wears toenail polish and long earrings all the time with eyeglasses, like she must be fast and smart at the same time. Like her name should be Miss Irene. That sounds fast and smart. Her hair is always fixed, too. Sometimes real short with tight, shiny curls. Aunt Della said they're called crocodile style or something. Sometimes tight on top and long and wavy in the back. Aunt Della said it's a piece. I like it when it's long and wavy. Nobody ever says anything to the sailor lady. Aunt Della said they have to keep their mouths shut and their men away from her and just watch and listen out for something. The woman and old lady next door sometimes watch her from the alley fence together. Sometimes she waves when she sees them and they wave back a little. But the woman says, well, I have to go see about those kids out loud when it looks like the sailor lady might want to come over and talk to them. And so this person, this outsider, is scapegoated, is used as a scapegoat. I mean, the whole little collection of scapegoats begins to build. Yeah, the outsider and the child is seen as somewhere strange or different because she talks to herself, because that's her alter ego, because how else would you endure what she's going through? And so here she is. Illness, especially if you have an illness that's related to anything woman-related, is seen as punishment for this great evil that you're either bringing to the community or to the family, or this evilness that is you. So if you're sick, cancer is seen as a manifestation of evil. And that's why. Why don't people get medical attention for these different conditions? And they could have lived if they lived, if they had gone to the doctor early enough, preventive care. No, because once you do that, it's you're labeled as okay. It was said that you have this, which means that you have to have been this evil person or had this evil riding you. And so here it is. The woman said that the doctors plucked Mrs. Stevens' insides from her just like you pluck gizzards from a chicken. Had to do it. Something was done to her to make her inside woman parts drive her crazy. And it all had something to do with the sailor lady, she said. First Thomas Stevens dropping dead like he did. Then what happened to his wife wasn't even a year after that, and her moving away all of a sudden. And ain't it funny that she moved into the very flat where all that went on by herself and all that house, and nobody ever saw a rent sign? Never was right after that, Jesse Stevens, Aunt Della said. Walked around with her eyes looking just as empty as inside of herself was. Wonder what became of her. Heard she wasn't any more good for a man. That's why her new husband ran off. House paid for, kids grown, had a new Buick with the insurance she got from Thomas's death. It's a shame when a man ain't worth shit till he's dead. Yeah, it is. I gotta do this story. It's a shame when a man ain't worth shit till he's dead. All men in here, make sure you wear something when you die. Because before you die, not after you did, okay? And Jesse still couldn't hold on to husband. Heard he said it was like just like falling into a big empty hole, couldn't feel nothing. And that woman over there now ain't never saw from inside nothing. Just a big truck pull up from nowhere full of stuff in her. Aunt Della was quiet for a moment, then said, ain't it funny how it was both of them? Never heard of both of them. Ain't no reason. What I want to know is how come. The woman bit her lip. Della, you can't hear for listening to yourself talk, she said. That's how they say sealers do. They put themselves on a man and make him come down with something so heavy he drops dead. Then as soon as his wife gets to feeling a little bad, they take what the husband did to her sickbed. It makes his wife come down sicker than she was till she's to the point of death. And she'll die too if she don't get help quick. Even if she gets help, what she did is still on her in the same place as the sealer used to make the husband heavy. It stays there heavy on the wife this time. Presses down till it makes her so crazy out of her head that it kills her. That's why they had to pluck Jesse's woman parts out. It was all they could do. And so this is the way that sickness is seen. It's never that with men. When men get sick, you know, they get punished after death. Death is the punishment. But women have to live with this evil that they've done, or with this evil that they carry. It's a kind of paranoid world. It is. Paranoia really runs kind of rampant in that world, because everyone is a suspect. Everyone is doing something to everyone. Because if something falls off the house, and the house is old, they're falling apart. Someone's suspected of doing something to make that happen. If your spouse is fooling around, the person the spouse is fooling around with is suspected of putting something on that person to get rid of them. Okay, and it goes on. It's just a vicious circle. So things are worked back and forth. People go to root workers back and forth to get something to do, undo what has been done to them, and to also get back at the person for doing what they did to them. Road workers are the most wealthy people in that world. They're very much needed. Most of the time, do they believe what they're doing and what they're doing? I really don't think so, because usually they make up the reason why these things happen as they happen. I know someone who in real life, we went to a root worker because her husband was fooling around on her and she was not feeling very good. And she went to the root worker, and the root worker said, oh, that's because your husband's wife put something on you. Got something and gave it to your husband to put on you. So I'm going to sell you this ring that's going to take away what was put on you. And sold her the ring for $100, and that was back in the 1960s. $100 was a lot more than it is now. Well, it's still a lot today, but even more, especially when you're poor. You give up everything to save your life, to give this to the root worker. And so she got the ring and wore it for 2 weeks, and it was a little dime store ring. You knew that. It was plastic. Wore the plastic ring for about 2 weeks so the thing broke. And she was terrified. She went to the root worker. I mean, everything is a symbol of something terrible, horrible. She went to the root worker and said the ring broke. And the root worker said, well, yeah, that's because they went to another root worker who gave something even more powerful, but I can sell you another ring that would even take away that. And since you're such a good customer, I'll give it to you for half the price, $50 this time. And so it goes on, vicious cycle, on. And the fights are not only with spouses, but with neighbors too. Here's the way it goes. The woman had a fight with the lady next door. Not with the old lady, but with the fat one who lives on the other side of us. It started when she accused the fat lady of throwing root powder into our yard, then called her a fat-ass, snuff-dipping, nappy-headed bitch. The lady came off her porch. I'm good with all those words. Yeah. The lady, if you want to cuss somebody out, get me. I'll give y'all the words, okay? The lady came off her porch and spit snuff right into the woman's face, and the fight began. The husband went out and tried to break it up, but the woman and the fat lady jumped on him and fought each other too. The husband just gave up and broke away and came into the house to watch the fight with me. A whole crowd of people had gathered around by then, including Aunt Della.
Hi.
Including Aunt Della. When the woman realized that the fat lady was getting the best of her, she screamed for Aunt Della to get a knife. But someone jumped on Aunt Della before she could even leave. Pretty soon the whole crowd was fighting and cussing at each other about all kinds of things that they had always wanted to tell each other about, I guess, but hadn't. The police came and broke the whole mess up. When they asked what started it, nobody said anything. So they made everyone go home, and that was the end of it. There's so much going on around here, so many fights, so much suspicion. It seems that almost everyone is working roots, including the woman, accusing and fixing each other for whatever, and then turning around and getting themselves unfixed from what they believe has been worked on them. The woman told Aunt Della that she sometimes pretends to be asleep at night so the husband go to sleep before she does. While he's sleeping, she hangs her drawers over his head. That's a real thing. All the women here, if you want to know how to keep your husband, when your husband goes to bed at night, hang your drawers over their head. You're guaranteed to keep them. I'm serious. Keep them, okay? If you want to know how to do a whole lot of things, listen here. And it's real, 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 real working things. I know about those things, okay? It helps weaken the roots of anyone who tries to fix her through him. And hanging her drawers over his head, she said, even keeps him from leaving her when he fools around with other women. The husband puts root powder down, too, when he thinks the woman's not around or paying attention. Then she sprinkles root powder in rooms where the husband has been to ward off the powder that he puts down. And they're both careful to hide their drawers from each other. They believe that some of the most powerful roots can be worked through the person who wears them. The old people next door even work roots. That's pretty hard to believe since they're always at Mass on Sunday and everyone in the parish likes them, but they do. And there's always a root work going on between their house and ours. It seems to be the only time the woman and husband are on each other's sides. The root wars only happen late at night when everyone else is sleeping. On most of those nights, I lay awake listening to them. The old people next door dig near the fence that separates their house from ours. I can hear the water run through the holes when they fill the holes they've dug with roots. And then I hear the scraping of the shovel again when they move the dirt back into the hole. Later, I can hear the woman and husband whisper while they dig up the roots that the old people have planted and then plant their own. And on the nights when I stay up late, I pretend to be busy while I strain my ears to hear what they're whispering when they spy on the old couple through the dining room window. In the daytime, they all act as though what had happened the night before didn't happen. They laugh and talk to each other across the same fence that they had planted the roots behind. And they even drive to Mass together after they've planted roots. I wonder why they're not afraid of hell. I even wonder sometimes if hell is just another place for root working. And the religion. It's all mixed up and all crossed into all of that. And the notion of what's learned in religion and what's in the Bible and what you've learned in church, the whole notion has still at its base the root working is this focus. Okay, how does this fit into root working? And what does that do with, and how is that just even processed? Here it is. This is after her mother finds out who the woman is, who her husband is having an affair with, and she confronts the woman and all this, and she confronts her husband about the affair, and a whole lot of stuff goes on, and the wife goes to the root worker to get something. And the root worker tells her the reason why her husband's having an affair and who she's having an affair with and all of that. And so here it goes. And what the woman he's having an affair with is doing to her through the husband who's getting roots from somewhere. The husband goes to Mass every Sunday by himself now. The first day I went over to sit with him, he said he needed to be alone. Ever since, he's been sitting by himself a few pews away where I can see him. A lady asked me why I don't go over to sit with him, and I told her I can't because he has to leave in a hurry as soon as Mass is over. The woman said that he goes to Mass just so that people will notice him and think he's changed. But I don't think he goes because of what people think. He went to confession last week, and he takes communion, too. It scares me sometimes. Aunt Della said that her brother-in-law did almost the same thing before he went off and dropped dead. Last Sunday, the woman asked the husband if he ever read the part in the Bible that talks about men who forsake their wives and children to lay down with wicked women, and the part about how much God said the sinners have to suffer. He didn't answer, just put on his hat and started out the door. The woman ran to the door after him. Means you're going to suffer something awful, she yelled. All the holiness and praying in the world ain't going to mean a thing. You're still going to suffer and pay for what you did. The husband came back from Mass and stood near the front door. He said, Jesus said, let he who ain't never sinned cast a stone out loud so the woman could hear him from the kitchen. Said that right here in the Bible. He didn't say another word, just took off his hat and went upstairs back to bed. That's what started the holy war. Not the real holy war, but what I call the holy war, because the woman and the husband keep looking for passages in the Bible to prove they're right. The woman told the husband to leave the other day, and he told her he couldn't. Then he pulled out his Bibles and read her the Let No Man Put Asunder passage and said they're both burning hell, and she put them out and said he could find that in the Bible, too. I don't know what you're so worried about, then the woman said to him, because, baby, this is hell. It's been hell for me and Marcus, too. The woman keeps stopping us from what we're doing to make us look for passages to write down. I thought it might be a sin, so I wrote, waste not, want not, 67 years and give me liberty. The woman said, I'm too stupid to even do that right. There's candles and stuff all over the house. Voodoo candles and blessed candles, holy water and voodoo oil. The husband brings the holy ones from the church and the woman brings the voodoo ones from the root workers. They use them against each other. Holy power against voodoo power, and they steal from each other whichever candle or oil they believe will give them the most power against the other. They get mad at each other over it too, fighting mad. One day the husband stole a candle from the woman and burned it. When she found out what he had done, she went at him. I hate going to Mass now almost as much as I hate going to the root workers. I hate seeing the husband there. I hate the sermons, the altar. Most of all, I hate the candles. I hate the novenas, the devotions, the indulgences for the souls in purgatory, all of the candles. I dream about candles all the time. I dream about candles and babies with no faces, candles and fighting, candles and cursing, screaming, root working, candles and men filling on me, candles and blood, candles and hell. I burn all of it. I burn the candles and I burn the oil of root powder and the Bibles. I put them in two big grocery bags and took them outside, made a fire in the oil drum, and watched them burn. The fire crackled and spit and the glass popped. I watched the bags float away into soot. And the wax from the holy candles and the voodoo candles melted together until I couldn't tell which was pagan and which was holy. More glass popped and the Bible pages singed to dust that looked like rook powder. The oil whined and the wax flowed. It reminded me of souls crying in purgatory, spirits crying. I wanted it to burn faster so that it would all end before the woman and the husband came home. But after a while, I didn't care what happened, as long as it was gone. I watched it. Hell and purgatory, sins and martyrs, spirits boost, fixes souls, charity, long-suffering. I watched it burn until the fire burned out and there was nothing left but ashes and scorched, broken glass. And because of what she had done, the root worker said that there was nothing but devils in her that's doing that. And so she worked the devils out of it. And so she said, what I got is stronger than the devils and I'll work them out of her, but it'll cost plenty. The woman pays her and she works on me. Twice a week now, I follow the woman up those long steps. I watch the root worker mix powder with some cooked stuff that smells like cod liver oil. She mixes it with whatever else she can get her hands on. Mud, pee, sometimes I don't know what it is. I drink it each time. I don't fight anymore. And it tastes different each time, but always nasty. I listen to her words that I never understand, but I know that the words are mad fighting. They sound mad fighting, always fighting. I listen until the whole room and everything in it becomes as mixed up as the words of the root worker said sometimes, sometimes, until I'm dizzy, heavy. Then she mixes a paste of some sort and she spreads it over my naked belly while I'm still sitting there. The paste is hot. And I ask myself every time, how can my belly be naked? Because I don't understand, all of my clothes are still on. Last Friday I started shaking and couldn't stop when she did it. The whole room shook too. I tried to hold on to the chair to keep from falling out of it, but my hands couldn't feel. I couldn't even feel my fingers. My legs and belly drew up into my neck and tied into a knot so tight I thought I was gonna die. I tried to tell them, but my mouth wouldn't open, so I didn't say anything. Just felt my knotted up body try to choke itself to death. I slipped out of the chair and onto the floor and shook Clarissa, and I watched the root worker reach down and pull a snake out of my belly. And so, how much time do I have? Where am I? 45 minutes, is that?
Yeah.
Okay, so I would like to open it up to everybody for questions or anything. Yep.
I was just wondering what kind of experience you had with this dialectic between religions, so to speak, sort of between the Catholicism and the root work in Detroit.
Oh, what kind of experience did I have?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, good question. Okay, first of all, the book's not is not autobiographical. I mean, somebody said, the book, Raynell's novel about herself. No, it's not about myself. None of these things happened to me. What's my connection to it? I was raised Catholic. I went to a Catholic school, so, you know, here's this whole thing with Catholicism. But also, Detroit is a... anybody here from Detroit? Okay. You're from where?
Farmington.
Oh, Farmington. No, you're not from Detroit. I mean, Detroit. Mother world. Okay. Detroit is one of the most Catholic cities in the country. I think it's like second or third after New Orleans. If you did an aerial view of Detroit. Especially the east side of Detroit, everything was built around parishes. In the middle of every clump of houses and stores, there's a rectory and a convent and a church. And that's the hub of the, okay. And I grew up on the lower east side of Detroit, and very, very parish, okay. And what happened in the 1960s, in the 1950s, it began with the 1950s with the outward expansion into the suburbs and with the white flight from Detroit. It was once a very, the east side of Detroit was a very ethnic, had ethnic enclaves. And our family moved into a neighborhood that was German, Italian, and Polish. Well, around our neighborhood was a German street. Surrounding streets were Italian and Polish, okay, and you knew who lived there by the architecture of the house and by the names of the parish churches. With that migration, outward migration, there was a, the Catholic Church wanted to keep the schools going. And so then they began to reach out to the black families who were migrating into the neighborhood to say, well, we'll, why don't you send your kids to our schools? And as an incentive, they would offer family packages with reduced tuition and all of that. And so I grew up Catholic. And that was a funny thing, that, that whole relationship is you're going to school, to this Catholic school that's very Catholic and very white, and you're coming home to your because by the time we were in there, this was the last, these were the last generation white families who had their kids still in the school. And so I went to a very white school and coming home to a very black neighborhood. With the black neighborhood, everyone black in the neighborhood didn't know about root working or practice root working. And here's this isolation. There was just this, the ones who believed in root working, who that little root working is trapped in so much secrecy. That not only, I mean, here you are going to this world that doesn't know anything about root working and doesn't know anything about how it's playing out. And you're a kid and you're saying things that you're hearing and picking up. And they're not, they're hearing it, the nuns and the priests and the other kids, and they don't even know what in the hell you're talking about, or they think you're talking about something different. But at the same time, there were other religions as well. There were mostly black, Baptist church was there. And so we were isolated. We were isolated from the people who were in the traditional black religions and the people who were our classmates in school, even though we're sitting there and we're talking about the same thing, supposedly, but how this process within that world, there's two different processes going on. And so you learn to, also, you know that you're carrying this secret with you. And you know that there's certain things you don't talk about. You know, you don't talk about these things and you don't connect. And when you're a child, yeah, some things, it's hard to disconnect the two. It's hard to say, well, is this right? Is this forbidden to talk about? Or you'll raise your hand and say, oh, is this, well, is that the same as a this or that? And I kind of talked about that. And then, well, then the explanation that's given is something entirely different from that. I mean, it's any kind of, yeah. So it's a kind of, it is very disjointed, disconnected, very isolated, yeah. So you have all these different kinds of isolations, yeah. Did that kind of answer it?
So this novel is more of a sort of isolationist theory novel?
Absolutely, yeah. All the levels of isolation and how that plays out. And then the isolation of language, too. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What reaction has the book received from root workers who read it?
What reaction did the book receive from root workers who read it? You know what? Let me tell you, oh man, this was something. Writing this book was really, really something. I started, I remember I was going to write just a book about root working and what that is and what that world is, and I was going to interview people who I knew. I mean, I'm so connected to these people, you know, and even some people were very, very close to me. And of course, there's this dialogue that's going on about it. You're talking about it, of course, you're connected to the world. It's very open, very connected. But as soon as I started asking questions, well, what are you going to do, write a book or something? Yeah, I'm going to write a book. Suddenly nobody knows anything. Nobody knew anything. I mean, nobody knew anything. It's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know anything about woodworking, what woodworking, what are you talking about? And so people got angry with me because I was writing the novel when I was in the process of writing the novel, okay? Because they thought it was going to be an indictment of them or that I was going to, everyone started. Everyone who never bought a book before bought the book to see where they were in this novel, you know? And it was really funny, but it was none of the people. But that was okay. But road workers don't care. I mean, first of all, they're not gonna go out and buy a book, okay? But then on the other hand, they really don't, well, no, some of them do. I mean, there's been, really, I mean, can it even, if road working even gets to the point of something fatal, okay? And there have been deaths that were tied to people with ties to Wayne State University and University of Michigan that was had as a, the whole thing all brought down to root working. And so, yeah, so I can't say I'm wrong. People who are root workers don't not go out and buy these books. But as a rule, yeah. Nothing from Michigan State. I never went as far as Lansing to see. They really wouldn't care because there's still, the most anger that I got was from people who thought I was going to make, that what I did was this website, Africana.com, they said that I was pathologizing a race of people for my, you know, great monetary gain. And novels don't make a lot of money unless they're well-known, best-selling, way mega-selling authors. But the book's not even about race. You know, the book's not about race. It's not about any of that. Most of the people who I know who are African-American don't know anything about woodworking. Most of them, not all of them. That I know now, who are African-American, don't know about woodworking. And so it's not an African-American cultural thing, but it is a class and isolation sort of thing. What happens when you're at the bottom of the bottom of the bottom of the barrel with class, when you're like, who's that? The Parliament Funkadelic said, I was down so low I could look up at my feet. When you're down that low, I mean, what happens with that isolation? And there's those people don't buy books, no. Why are you gonna buy a book when you can get something, a fix taken off of you? You can invest the money in a number that's gonna take you out. What they do sell is hope, yeah. And I mean, hope is so, and somebody interviewed me and asked me, here's the way the language thing goes. I was interviewed by an online web newspaper magazine. They asked me, how do you see hope in this novel? You know, like The Bastard Out of Carolina, there seems to be, and like in The Bluest Eye, the very little hope, but then, yep, there is a ray of hope. And how do you see hope in this novel? And you can tell by the way that the question is framed that hope is a good thing. I mean, it's okay. In the larger world, hope is a good thing. It's a great thing, okay? Well, at last there's a ray of hope. In that world, a ray of hope will kill you. That's what keeps you stuck. That's what keeps you from getting out of the situation. That's what keeps you just, it's like spinning your wheels and digging deeper and deeper and deeper into the mud. So the only way to be saved is to lose hope, to give up hope. And then you can get out of it. It's that kind of thing. But no, for the most part, no, I didn't get that. I didn't get any backlash from root workers. I wish I did, because then I would, controversy sells. I mean, the controversy would have sold millions of copies of the book and all of that. Wow, that would have been something. Yeah, but no, they didn't. And road workers aren't people who will turn around and send somebody to get you. They might work something on you to get even with you. if they really believe in what they're doing. But anyone can be a root worker, you know, anybody, as long as you can sell someone hope, and as long as you know some of the things that, some of the root working things that you do, to root working paraphernalia and stuff that you do to work roots. But there, it is based on a real thing, and there are real things that happens in root working. Yeah. Yes. So, and I sound weird, don't I? So, yeah, sorry. No, they didn't come out to me, no. Nobody came out to me, no. Any more questions?
I have one. I kind of know how to word it, and it might be kind of silly, mm-hmm. but when you were reading, it reminds me of the movie of East Volume. So is there like any type of similarities or just a relationship between your book and East Volume and the things being talked about?
About, you know, East Volume, and it's sort of like, East Bayou was a nice movie. It was a nice book, okay, but it wasn't. East Bayou was played into that mystical side of working words. It wasn't the real reality. The movie and the book was intended for the outsider, and it was written so for something that the outsider would connect to. It didn't reveal what actually goes on in that world. It's what do you, the outside, what will I show you when you come into my world? Okay, this is what you'll see, and that's what East Bayou did. And so, and Midnight and Garden of Good and Evil, the same thing. I mean, they're great, I mean, really good books. You know, but of course, it was written by an outsider, too. Yeah, and if you're an outsider, you really don't know. I mean, it's like cleaned up and dressed up, and this is it. And yeah, we will throw in some of the stuff to make you wonder. And you know what, in the world of working, it really is stuff that makes you wonder. You know, it really is, because it is based on something that's very real, and there's things that really do happen. But the things that really do happen are not without consequence to the people who live in that world, and particularly the very youngest people. And that's the consequence. There's very real consequence. So yeah. And that's, you know, you don't see that. And consequence to relationships. You never see the root worker's husband, what goes on in their homes and in the homes of the people who believe in it, and what happens when that person takes this home and the wife happens to drop dead. What's all the stuff that played into that, and what played into all of these in-betweens? And that's not, you know, it's not there. And so, yeah, but it's, but not to say it's not a good book, it's a great book. I really like the book. Yeah. Any more?
Well, thank you very much. Sure.